Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, one of the most curious phenomena is the common cause being made against America, freedom-loving people, our Constitution, and our safety by unlikely partners, namely the jihadists or Sharia supremacists, if you will, on the one hand, and the left, particularly the rather hard left, that seems to be perfectly prepared to throw in with the jihadis in order to take down America. It is a conundrum when, after all, it would appear that they don't have much in common. After all, on the left, they think rather highly, we're told, of, feminists and homosexuals and Jews and apostates and the like. And on the Islamist side, they're very, very hostile to all of the above, to the point, in a number of cases, of killing them. To help us sort this out, I'm very pleased to say we're joined for a full hour of interesting, thoughtful, and informed conversation by Matthew Vadim. He is the Senior Vice President of the Capital Research Center. It's best known as America's investigative think tank. He has contributed massively to the public policy debate on a whole host of issues, notably to such outlets as frontpagemagazine.org, American Thinker, pjmedia.com, The Daily Caller, The American Spectator, and on and on. But I'm particularly pleased that he recently contributed to the Center for Security Policy's Civilization Jihad Reader Series by publishing with us Team Jihad, How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States. Matt Vadim, it's so good to have you with us, and thank you for giving us an hour of your time to talk about this important book and the topic that you have addressed in it so wondrously. Welcome back. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Frank.
So, Matt, let's start with the nature of this Team Jihad. What is the explanation for how people who seem to have such different priorities, such heightened sensitivities or antipathies, as the case may be, towards certain populations, and yet they're making common cause against America, as you say, to destroy the United States?
Well, right. It may seem counterintuitive to many. Their shared antipathy for the United States allows them to work together and to overlook their otherwise, you'd think, irreconcilable differences. The old saying that's applicable here is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so both of them hate the United States and individual rights and the freedoms that we embrace here in America. And so they have decided to work together to bring down America, or at least to put America, in their view, in its place, to knock it down a few pegs.
Or take it down, as the case may be. And Matt, again, the nature of this consortium, if you will, is something that I guess we've seen historically other nations watching play out. I'm thinking you participated in a wonderful online program when we rolled out your book a couple of weeks ago, and we talked on that occasion about the Iranian Revolution and what happened when the Khomeinists made common cause with communists, secularists, Democrats, and the like. How did that work out, Matt?
Well, it worked out fine for the Sharia supremacists who took over, but the left quickly found out that they were the ones that were first on the extermination list, the proscription list, and the regime went after them with an vengeance because they were just temporary allies used to accomplish the goal of seizing power. And so they found that they were no longer in favor and that all of their liberal or progressive ideas were actually not popular, and they and there was a crackdown against them.
Yeah, well, they may have been popular. They were not welcome among the new ruling elite. That's for sure. A number of them died, as I recall. Others of them found themselves imprisoned or exiled, I guess, in the best case. Do you think that's a one-off, Matt, or is that actually likely to be replicated in the future, given the really deep-seated animosity towards some of those groups that I just mentioned among the Sharia supremacist cohort and their ideology of Sharia?
Well, I would say the process is bound, in this case, is bound to repeat itself. You know, it's not true that history always repeats itself, but in this case, we know enough about the way that Sharia supremacists operate that we know that it is going to happen again. They want their way of thinking and living and doing things not to be not to have a seat at the table, not to be a peer with other systems. They want it to be dominant. They insist upon it. And so they will push out or crowd out or kill off their opposition until they have total power. And that's just the way that it's always been. When they've been infiltrating new countries and new societies.
Well, and it does make absolutely stunning the fact that the left has learned nothing from these bad past experiences and is in the process really enabling the jihadis. It seems to me, Matt Vadim, they're not only teaching them how the West's constitutions or democratic processes or fundamental freedoms can best be exploited, they're actually enabling them to do it, in part by sometimes making excuses for them, other times simply mau-mauing those who oppose them.
Well, you know, there's still a lot of leftists are not educable. There are still university professors around, quite a few of them, that will make excuses for Joseph Stalin. Even now that we know, the horrors that he inflicted on his own people, they'll say that the communism was a great idea, but that, you know, it wasn't, they didn't go after it with enough vigor, that one of these days they'll just get it right. So, you know, leftists have a nasty habit of denying reality in order to accomplish their goals. So it's really not at all that surprising that, they keep getting slaughtered by Sharia supremacists whenever and wherever they take over, and they don't learn from the process. They don't want to learn from the process,
which is our bane, because they will in the process put us at greater and greater risk, unfortunately. Hey, Matt, we're talking about, of course, your new book, Team Jihad: How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States. And I just want to give you a chance quickly to talk a little bit about the practice you describe in Chapter 3 of lies, grandstanding, and sedition. Is sedition actually what we're now watching play out here?
Well, I would say we are, yes. It's well accepted in the Muslim community, something called the doctrine of, or the idea of taqiyya. And taqiyya is a doctrine that justifies lying to non-Muslims in order to protect or advance Islam, including the goal of Islamic jihad. So, you know, when Congressman Keith Ellison, a Muslim, or Congressman Andre Carson speaks, how do we don't know if they're telling the truth, because their higher loyalty is to Sharia, not to the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, a fascinating thought. Hold it, Matt. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about how in both of those individuals' cases, we really see the merging of the radical left with the Islamists. That and more we'll be discussing in our next block with Matthew Vadim right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're speaking with Matthew Vadim of the Capital Research Center. He is their senior vice president and a very, very considerable contributor both to their work product and to our thinking about what on earth we are facing on so many fronts. We'll be talking about them in the course of this hour-long program. But first, I wanted to pick up where we left off a moment ago, Matt Vadim, with respect to these two individuals in the United States Congress. Keith Ellison of Minnesota, representing primarily, it seems, Somali and very leftist Democratic population in Minneapolis, and Andre Carson of Indiana. These are two individuals that have been very closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood over the years. They've also come up through the ranks of the pretty hard left. Ellison is a particular concern to me, and I imagine to you too, insofar as he is now the deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee. So talk a little bit more about Takiya, as these guys exhibit it, and what their ultimate agenda may actually be.
Well, to Keith Ellison and let me talk about Andre Carson for a moment. He's the congressman, Democrat, and a Muslim from Indiana. He took, I believe, the seat of his grandmother, who was I think Julia Carson, who was a congresswoman, and he he's hard left, and he is an outspoken Islamist, and he, you know, if you criticize him, he'll vilify you and demonize you and use all sorts of unfair, you know, rhetorical tactics against you. What's really noticeable about, here's an example of Takiya, not necessarily to advance Islam, but at least the idea of lying in order to advance a leftist goal. Andre Carson is one of the sources. You remember when the Congress was voting on Obamacare back in early 2010, and as House members were crossing the street to walk to the U.S. Capitol Dome in Washington, D.C., to vote or debate on Obamacare, there was an angry crowd. They were not violent, but they were loud and angry, and they were, you know, yelling and protesting and holding signs. These are conservatives and Tea Party people and so on. And it was claimed that the N-word, the racist epithet you cannot utter in American society, was hurled at Congressman John Lewis, the former civil rights leader, who's now a congressman from a Democrat from Atlanta, the Atlanta area. And it made tremendous headlines, and it helped to paint Obamacare opponents as, you know, terrible people, as racists and so on. The only problem is it never happened. And the late Andrew Breitbart at the time put out in a land where, in a society nowadays where cell phones and recording devices are ubiquitous, more or less, he put out a $100,000 reward if anyone could come up with actual footage of someone, you know, calling Congressman John Lewis the N-word. And no one ever claimed the reward. And yet Andre Carson gave an interview to the Washington Times, and he said that he was the source for this statement. And then he heard it something like, not just once or twice, okay? It wasn't just something that could have been misunderstood. He said it was something like 10 or 12 times.
Well, this is interesting. We are down in the weeds a little bit. Let me pull you back to let me ask you, when you mention the attacks on those who are critical of Andre Carson, Keith Ellison, others of their friends and colleagues that are associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, or for that matter, the Sharia supremacist program more generally. There's a technique that is widely used by these individuals and organizations called Islamophobia. Tell us a little bit about the derivation of that term and its use, essentially to silence critics of all of this.
Well, Islamophobia is a concept that was invented by Muslims trying to advance Islam and Sharia and Jihad some decades ago. And the idea was that anybody who criticizes Islam is a bad person, is a hater, a bigot, a racist even, although Islam is not a race. It's more akin to a religion or a belief structure with a religious veneer about it. And anybody who criticizes Islam is called an Islamophobic. And it is playing upon the power of the epithet, the racist epithet in American society. If you accuse somebody of being intolerant or, you know, bigoted, that's pretty well the worst thing you can accuse somebody of in American society today. So they are trying to capitalize on this cultural phenomenon by trying to protect something that needs to be debated, that people need to be skeptical of, and that is Islam. So they are getting people, and also they're relying, they're preying on people's good nature. People want to be polite. People want to be accepting of other cultures and religions, and so people then it short circuits the process whereby people even examine what Islam is all about, and they just treat it as it's just another religion, as opposed to a hateful ideology that seeks to exterminate all those who oppose it.
Right, with, as you say, a veneer of religiosity over it. But Matt Faden, two points occur to me. One is that you've got a term that, as I understand it, actually was sort of an invention initially of a think tank closely aligned with some of these Islamists in the United Kingdom. And they basically just took the success that the left had with cultivating this notion that there's some wild-eyed, irrational fear of homosexuals, namely homophobia, and converting it into a similar kind of clinical disorder. So we've got that on the one hand, again, the left helping to equip and enable these guys. And then on the other, you have the really vicious use of this kind of epithet to essentially silence critics. And this really is akin to, if not a manifestation of, Sharia blasphemy restrictions, isn't it?
Well, right. Yes, you're right. Blasphemy—the idea that you can't be the crime of saying something unmentionable about a religion, and you know, defying its attacking its tenets, I suppose, is an oversimplification of the crime of blasphemy,
which is a capital offense when you're offending Muslims, it turns out.
Well, yeah, according to Muslims, that's right. In Islam, it is. In Islamic countries, it can be. Yes, absolutely. You can't insult the Prophet Muhammad. And, in those countries, you have to be very, very careful what you say and do, because people are taking notes and they're writing things down.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. You don't have free speech. And the question is, if this is tolerated in the West, and it certainly is being in Europe at the moment, as you know, Matt Faden, and could well eventuate here as well if we're not careful in the guise of hate speech and that sort of thing, notwithstanding our First Amendment rights. So it's imperative that we're alive to these dangers, and I'm so grateful to Matt Faden, our guest, for his contributions to our appreciation of this danger with his new book, Team Jihad, How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States. You can find it at Amazon or get it downloadable for free at securefreedom.org. We'll be right back with more with Matt Vadim of the Capital Research Center, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking for this full hour with Matthew Vadim of the Capital Research Center. It's widely regarded as America's investigative think tank. You can find his writings there and also at such terrific outlets as frontpagemagazine.org, American Thinker, PJ Media, Daily Caller, and The American Spectator. Also, bombthrowers.com, a new one to me. Let me ask you, Matt, to pick up on some of the things that you were describing a moment ago in a specific context, namely the role being played by a group called the Southern Poverty Law Center in trying to, in a way, I guess, impose these kinds of Sharia blasphemy restrictions by designating certain groups, notably mine, the Center for Security Policy, me personally, as haters and bigots and so on for describing, I believe, truthfully, accurately, and necessarily what we're up against in terms of this Sharia supremacism. What is the SPLC, as it's known, and what role is it playing at the moment?
The Southern Poverty Law Center purports to be a public interest civil rights law firm, and it's based in Alabama, and it has its best funded nonprofits I know of anywhere in the world. It's got more than $1.3 billion in combined assets, and has bank accounts in offshore tax havens in the West Indies.
That seems a little peculiar for an outfit with poverty in its name.
Yeah, well, but they're not really about poverty, and you have to wonder what about the origins of the name, which I can't really speak to. But, you know, it came out of the civil rights era.
It was good for fundraising, I think.
Definitely. And its head, Morris Dees, is a champion fundraiser.
The character behind this is, as I understand it, been on the record as being all about making money. Less so, I think, you know, sticking with the facts and protecting the rights of minorities. So, Matt, in terms of how it has operated, in particular in recent years, there was a time when it was seen as the scourge of the Ku Klux Klan, but of late, it's mostly, it seems, been aligned with and enabling, as others have, as we've been discussing on the left, been the Islamists. Are there no hate groups among the Islamists, according to the SPLC?
I think the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, lists Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam as a hate group. I think that's just about the only one, though. There might be a few other minor ones scattered here and there, but generally groups like CARE, Council of American Islamic on American Islamic Relations, and MSA, Muslim Students Association, and the various other Muslim advocacy groups don't get caught in Southern Poverty Law Center's radar. They regard them as clients, more or less, as victims of oppression, and because they espouse Islam and Sharia law, and the Southern Poverty Law Center comes to their defense, even though supporting Islam means, by definition, supporting intolerance and a kind of cultural and, you know, religious imperialism.
Well, that's certainly true, most especially of those who are Sharia adherent. And one of the things that does seem to be peculiar, to say the least, is that, the SPLC, which is very quick to pillory organizations that it considers to be homophobic, to use that term again, or to be insensitive to women's rights, or notably their right to have an abortion and the like. These are people who are going to get rather bad treatment, as you say, Matt, at the hands of the Sharia types. I just can't fathom what they're up to, unless it's a kind of pay-for-play scheme. Is that what your research suggests?
I don't think the Southern Poverty Law Center needs anybody's money at this point, although they're always playing poor. I think they really believe that Islamic so-called civil rights groups require their assistance, because these people are hardcore radical leftists at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They are completely in the thrall of identity politics and multiculturalism and whatever, and I think we should respect them enough at least to think that they're being sincere. To use a colloquialism, they're coup.
Oh, well, that's charitable, my book. I think they're cynical, and they are taking advantage of these opportunities to work with well-funded Islamist groups for profit as well.
They may be, but even if they weren't getting any money out of doing that, I think they would still do it, because they believe in the cause. They're messed up in the head, identity politics leftists,
as they see it. Yes. Hey, Matt, let me ask you about this group that you've just mentioned, the Council on American Islamic Relations. It's got quite a pedigree, according to the federal government. Talk a little bit about it and what role it plays in the Team Jihad operation.
Well, yes, it was founded by people with ties to Muslim terrorists and Muslim terrorist organizations, particularly Hamas, the terrorist group over in the Middle East.
The Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian franchise. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. I forget how Hamas. I recently learned is an acronym, but I can't remember what it stands for. It's something in Arabic. But it has ties with these groups, and it was founded by shady characters, and its leader is Nihad Awad, and he is an effective representative of their views, but he has ties to all these Islamic radicals all over the world. And when nobody's looking, they say what they really believe. And back in the early days of CARE, they made it clear that they were there to help make Islam the dominant force in the United States.
Not to be just in another religion. It was to be over all of them. And this is, of course, Sharia supremacism at its essence, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it's not – religion is just a part of it. And that's what they use – the religious aspect of it is what they use mostly in America in order to disarm people.
Right. Notably in the faith community. Hey, Matt, what you've just described, of course, is an influence operation. And the federal government established this in the Holy Land Foundation trial, as you mentioned, introducing into evidence there a wiretap of the organizational meeting of CARE between Nihad Awad and others who went on to run the operation even to this day. And Hamas representatives, and we have a book on this subject called CARE is Hamas, also available for free at securefreedom.org. I urge you to check that one out as well. And again, to drill this point home, Matt Vadim, the organizations like CARE, working together with organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, are, it seems to me, indisputably a much more formidable and ominous combination of threats to our country than either one of them would be individually. Is that how you see it?
I'd say that's a fair assessment, Frank, that these people are more powerful when they unite their forces and agree upon a common message and a common goal, and this is what they do, and the media feeds into this. The media uncritically picks up reports and press releases from CARE and from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and puts them out there as if they're, the unadulterated truth, which is a very dangerous thing to do.
It is indeed, especially doing it uncritically. It's dangerous as well as irresponsible. Hey, Matt, we've got to pause for one last break. When we come back, we're going to ask the author of Team Jihad, How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States, to talk about a specific and very worrying case study, the Obama bomb deal, the nuclear accord with Iran, right after this.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's our final installment of a very interesting and, I think, very needed conversation with Matthew Vadim of the Capital Research Center. And in particular, we're exploring with him his findings in an important new monograph available from the Center for Security Policy Press, also available for free at securefreedom.org, entitled Team Jihad. It's a discussion of how those in the Sharia supremacist movement make common cause with those in the left, as he puts it, to destroy the United States. And Matt, I can't think of a better way to describe what was going on during the Obama era when the administration completed, in a fashion, an arrangement with the Iranian government to essentially allow it to continue building nuclear capabilities, albeit to fend off, we were told for a time, actually fulfilling that ambition, but nonetheless, to bring them ever closer to it and to give them enormous amounts of money and political legitimacy and otherwise to support the regime in exchange. Would you talk about that as kind of a case study of how this leftist Sharia supremacist axis has operated to our great detriment?
The left and the Sharia supremacists have been working together for a long time, and they have great influence in the media, and they can call upon journalists and reporters from the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, Miami Herald, all these prestigious newspapers. They can call upon them to disseminate the message that they want and the lie they've been telling for decades, but they really ramped it up after 9/11, was that Islam means peace, that Islam is a gentle religion, and that it's about it's tolerant and it accommodates other people. Now, there have been periods in Islam's history when it has been like that, but they're generally pretty short-lived and they're not widespread. They'll only occur in little pockets around the world, like in Morocco and Egypt periodically. Islam, is advanced by the left and by the media. I guess I repeat myself there, and they put forward this message that Islam is, as I said, a religion of peace, and it's not. In fact, the word Islam in Arabic means surrender or submit. Submit to the will of Allah. It's a totalitarian set of belief structures, a totalitarian philosophy, with this religious architecture around it.
And as that relates to Iran in particular, this is, of course, a Sharia supremacist regime there, and the prospect that it is going to be armed in due course and frankly, quite possibly very soon, with the most destructive weapons imaginable, is a chilling thought. And yet, Matt Vadim, it seems as though the left in the Obama administration, plus the Muslim Brothers and other Sharia supremacists and sympathizers in that administration, were able to collaborate very effectively, notably through the work of Ben Rhodes in the National Security Council to essentially get this deal through in the United States. Could you talk a little bit about Ben Rhodes and the role that he played and how this is kind of exemplary of Team Jihad at work?
Right. Well, what Ben Rhodes did is he gave a very revealing interview to the New York Times, or it may have been the New York Times Magazine, in the final months of the Obama administration, and he admitted that he had sold a bill of goods to journalists that he knew he could use as mouthpieces to get the message out there. Chief among them was now the editor, Jeffrey Goldberg, who was an editor at The Atlantic Magazine, but now is the editor-in-chief at The Atlantic Magazine, and he could always be counted on, according to the article that featured Ben Rhodes, to spread the message uncritically. He would put it out there. And so a case was made that Iran has reformed, that it's got moderate people in power. Then you had people like the New Republic's that leftist writer, Peter Beinart, who is saying, oh, well, it's time for this natural alliance with the great nation of Iran to be resumed, and it was going to lead to all sorts of wonderful things. You know, he didn't mention how every day they have death to America and death to Israel rallies in Tehran.
I'd add in another personal favorite of mine, Joe Cirincione at the Plowshares Fund, who was helping spread money around to enable these sorts of things. And Trita Parsi, a former Iranian national who was very actively involved in promoting this deal. He's been called part of the Iran lobby by the regime's press outlets. I mean, this was an extraordinary Team Jihad at work.
They did to support this bungled arms control agreement with Iran that has holes so big in it you could drive an 18-wheeler through. They are, it's an utterly unenforceable agreement. And, you know, if anything, it's going to help the Iranians get nuclear weapons sooner than they otherwise would have, all the while posing as an effort at arms control. It's really bizarre, but somehow they managed to sell this crock of lies to the American public, and they even got got Republicans in Congress to go along with it, which always amazes me how spineless Republicans can be.
Well, indeed, Matt, I'm not sure they actually did sell the public on this. I think the public was very much opposed, but they did sell, it seemed, some in the leadership in Congress who went along with an arrangement there, as you know, that essentially made it impossible to stop this deal. And you know, the extent to which that may have been motivated by considerations that were putting the best face on giving something like $150 billion to the regime, because it would be then able to buy, oh, I don't know, airplanes from us, for example, a similar appetite raging, of course, in a number of European capitals.
That was the shipment, right? That was the shipment of bushels of cash.
Well, that was to get hostages out, I think. But there was $150 billion that was transferred, roughly, given to the Iranians. And quite apart, Matt Vadim, from whether they actually will be better able or able more quickly to get nuclear weapons or not, those cash transfers have clearly enormously increase the Iranians' ability to engage in terrorism or to try to undermine others in the region and dominate that important part of the world. It's again, it's a prime example, and I'm so grateful to you for your analysis of all this, of the Team Jihad at work to, I fear, advance the cause of destroying the United States. Final thought?
I agree. This Team Jihad collaboration between leftists and Sharia supremacists will use any lie, any opportunity, any tactic available to them in order to deceive and to advance their cause, which is at its core anti-American in nature, and they will never quit until they accomplish their goal. And so we have to be vigilant and keep our eyes on these people at all times.
And more to the point, stop them. Matthew Vadim of the Capital Research Center, I cannot thank you how much. I appreciate your time so much today, as well as the time that you put into this splendid monograph. It is really required reading if you're trying to make sense of the nature of the threats we're facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. It's entitled, once again, Team Jihad, How Sharia Supremacists Collaborate with Leftists to Destroy the United States. You can find it at Amazon or at securefreedom.org. Matthew Vadim, thank you so much for joining us. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.